From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A process called civil asset forfeiture can threaten your property if a law enforcement agency suspects you of engaging in illegal activity but never charges you with a crime. We'll hear from an expert who shares concerns about the process. A North Carolina congressman is among the most vocal supporters of an effort to reform federal financial rules. You'll learn why. One of the leading conservative U.S. senators of the past decade recently visited Raleigh to support a convention of states. You'll learn what that means. And you'll learn why the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a state law dealing with sex offenders and social media. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina's new general fund budget took effect July 1st. Now, the plan boosts spending, but still meets prudent limits on government growth. That assessment comes from the John Locke Foundation's Senior Vice President, Becky Gray. She has actually pored over the $23 billion plan that was actually vetoed by Governor Roy Cooper, but quickly overridden by the Republican supermajorities in both chambers. Becky joins us now to take a look at what this budget means for you and me. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
So Governor Cooper evidently wanted to spend a lot more money, and he didn't like the tax relief that was in this budget plan. But the Republican supermajorities said, we want this plan to go forward, and it's now law.
Right. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a budget, which is very good news. This, of course, is for the next 2 years, so North Carolina government is in very good shape. They have what I feel like is a very responsible budget, offers tax relief to citizens across the board. 99% of North Carolina taxpayers, I think, will receive some sort of tax cuts. But it does a lot more, Donna. There's a $23 billion budget. It's not just about tax cuts. It is about the tax cuts. It is about the spending, but it's also where that spending is and the priorities that the General Assembly has laid out. I think that it's a budget that I know with the research we've done here on it, it is a very fiscally responsible budget that continues the reforms and the economic growth that we've seen in North Carolina over the last 5 or 6 years.
And let's clarify something for our listeners. We're saying it's a biennial state budget, 2 years, but $23 billion refers to the first year that began July 1st.
Correct, yeah. And this is the way the General Assembly does it. You know, that's why our General Assembly sessions are 2 years. So kind of think in those two-year increments, if you will. So the first year that the General Assembly is in session, they pass a budget for the two-year time period. So we've actually got sort of companion budgets, if you will, as we look through that. Then when they come back for the short session in May, they'll take a look at next year's budget and make adjustments to depending on revenue and maybe some changes in priorities and those kind of things. So it really, you know, that's a great point that you make. And so what it does is it lays out the priorities, not just for this year, but for this whole legislative two-year biennium time period.
This plan for this fiscal year that is about a week old now includes more savings into the savings reserve fund. And we've now got quite a hefty reserve fund.
Largest it's ever been in North Carolina. I mean, this is a big deal. And you know, Donna, let me back up just a little bit from that. The reason why this is so significant, when Republicans took over the General Assembly in 2011, our state was really struggling. We were trying to get out of the recession, you know, trying to get our fiscal feet back on the ground, if you will. And that first year that they were in power in 2011, they found that they had a $650 million shortfall in the budget. Not only that, there was no money put aside in savings. So if you think about our coastline, if you think about the likelihood of us being hit by hurricanes, thank goodness we didn't have major storms during that time period because we didn't have any money set aside to help. You know, where we've seen this year, the victims of Hurricane Matthew with the flooding and the other things, there's been money available to reach out in those communities and help the small businesses get back on their feet, to repair the water and sewer damage that has been done, to repair the roads down there, those kind of things. This is why savings is so important. And this General Assembly understands this. And as you said, they have made that a priority. They have put money aside in savings. Now that our economy is recovering, we're doing really well. We actually have surplus revenue these days. So where we're seeing that is some of that money is being returned to taxpayers, but a lot of that money is being put into savings for rainy day, for capital improvement, so that we have something to repair our businesses, state government businesses across the, or buildings across the state, and also to offer a little bit of cushion there. You know, we're in great financial, fiscal shape in North Carolina. We want to stay there. And so if we have a downturn in the economy, due in large part for things way beyond our control, if the economy dips down again, we've got some money in reserve that we can count on until we can get back on our feet. That's why the savings is so important.
Becky, this budget seems to continue a trend of the last several budget cycles where we're attempting and actually being successful at keeping spending growth in check, but at the same time making investments in things that North Carolinians want and expect, education, criminal justice, and safety. How is it possible the legislature is able to do those two things? Because a lot of people will tell you, you can't do those.
Well, and yeah, and Donna, that's kind of a new thing in North Carolina, too. You know, we didn't see that for years and years and years. What we saw was when times were good, money was spent. When times were bad, taxes were raised. Then when times were good again and there was additional revenue, all the money was spent. What we have now is just a real different way of looking at things. As you mentioned, there has been a reining in of government spending. Actually, the last several budget cycles, all the budgets since 2011 have been under the growth of inflation plus population. That's a measure other states have used. You may have heard of a Tabor limit to spending. That's what they're talking about, where you limit the growth of government. Now, we don't have a constitutional amendment. We don't even have a statute that says that you do that. We have leaders and leadership that understands the importance of reining in that spending. Now, the other thing is there's plenty of money to spend. When we have $23 billion, and when you bring all the federal money in, we're talking over $50 billion. We have a lot of money. It's how and where you spend it. So it's a matter of setting priorities and also ensuring that every tax dollar that is spent to the very best that it can possibly be spent. Accountability, have measures in place. You know, education is a great place for that example. There's been a real change in sort of the attitude of that education spending to ensure that the dollars and the resources go in the classroom that directly affects the children. There's been a rollback in administration, a lot of the bureaucracy. Again, putting that money where the biggest bang is. And that, it's just a real different way of doing business. And other people have said, you know, it can't be done, as you mentioned. North Carolina is a model for the country. It can be done, and we're doing it.
Another priority in this budget is to make sure that working North Carolinians are able to keep more of what they earn. And Becky, this time around, a real focus from the General Assembly on folks who are living on the margins, low-income families, moderate-income families, really focusing on that tax relief for them.
Right. And what they've done with this is they have increased the standard deduction, or another way to put it, they have increased the zero tax bracket significantly from, I think when we started this, it was $6,000 for a married family filing jointly. Now it's $18,500. With this new budget, it will be $20,000. That's, you pay no taxes on that first part of your income. And the folks that are affected the most by that are low-income families, because that $20,000 is a larger part of their income. So this has been, again, when you have, I've been very puzzled hearing some people say, I've heard the governor say this, that these tax cuts are only for the rich people. Nothing could be further from the truth. When you make a zero tax burden for low-income, middle-class families, this is what we're talking about, the tax cuts for middle-class, low-income families that are greatly impacted by these revisions that we've seen.
We've got about 100 or so of these specific companies or nonprofits who have money earmarked for them. What's that all about?
Some people have said it's up to $100 million of these earmarked projects. But these are going into many of our rural areas for downtown revitalization, for projects in those rural areas. We keep talking about how do we ensure that our rural areas have the resources they need not to fall behind the rest of the state. And a lot of these projects are going into those rural areas. So I think, you know, one of the things that I would suggest is people are looking at that to really look at each of those projects individually.
And, of course, Becky will be writing more and more about this as the days go by. You can find all of that at johnlock.org. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the more troublesome topics in legal circles these days involves something called civil asset forfeiture. That might sound like a subject that would interest only lawyers, but our next guest will help us understand why anyone concerned about property rights should pay attention to the issue. Darpana Sheth is senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. She recently spoke about civil asset forfeiture with the Triangle Lawyers chapter of the Federalist Society. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're going to get into a lot of details, but first, for people who are unfamiliar with this, what is civil asset forfeiture?
Civil forfeiture is the government's power to confiscate property that's suspected of being involved in a crime. Now, it's different than criminal forfeiture that actually requires a criminal conviction. So unlike criminal forfeiture, civil forfeiture allows police and law enforcement to seize property they suspect of being involved in a crime without necessarily filing any kind of criminal charge, much less getting a conviction.
And does the property have to have anything to do with the suspected crime?
Yes. And so that's the link. There has to be some nexus or connection between the property and the crime. But the standard is very broad, at least under federal laws, for example. It's any kind of personal or real property that may have been used to, quote, facilitate a crime. And that facilitation language is interpreted very broadly by the courts.
That sounds like it could be very wide-ranging. Almost anything that's your property could be targeted for this.
Exactly.
Just how big a problem is this across the country?
It is a huge problem. So, for example, a very detailed report by the Washington Post, they did an investigative series, and in a six-part investigative series, they found that law enforcement, state and local law enforcement, had seized over $2.5 billion from motorists on our nation's highways since 9/11, all without any kind of warrant or indictment. And that's just highway seizures. The same thing is happening at our nation's airports. And the third kind of forfeitures we often see are something called structuring forfeitures, which is where the government, especially the IRS and the Justice Department, have been aggressive about seizing bank accounts owned by individuals and small business owners because there's been a pattern of frequently depositing less than $10,000. And that's a crime under federal law because there's currency reporting requirements. And if you fail to comply with those, that's a crime. It's also a crime to try to evade those reporting requirements by purposely breaking up your transactions. But in these structuring cases, all they have, there's no evidence of any illegal activity. The only thing the government is relying on is a pattern of less than $10,000 deposits. And a lot of innocent people and small business owners especially have a very good reason for doing so. Their insurance policies will only cover cash losses up to $10,000.
Some people might be hearing us and saying to themselves, wait a minute, law enforcement officers are going after the bad guys, and this is just one tool they use to get these bad guys. Why is that not the right way to approach this?
Well, that's what criminal forfeiture is for. No one in America should lose their property without being convicted of a crime. And so the problem with civil forfeiture is really twofold. First, it has lower protections for property owners. So, for example, the standard of proof is very low. The government just, in order to seize property, simply needs probable cause to seize the property that is connected to a crime. Then the government only has to show to forfeit the property that it's more likely than not that the property is connected to a crime. And then the burden flips to the property owner, which is a complete reversal of our American presumption of innocence, to affirmatively prove that they didn't know about or consent to the illegal activity. And so these kind of procedures stack the deck against property owners. Because it's a civil proceeding, they don't have any right to counsel. And there's all sorts of less procedural safeguards that property owners enjoy. And the second reason is because it's not only – civil forfeiture is not only easier for law enforcement to pursue, but it's lucrative to do so. In most states, in 36 or 38 states plus the federal government, law enforcement gets to keep the forfeited property or its proceeds and use it how it sees fit. And that creates a very direct financial incentive to seize and forfeit as much property as possible.
We are chatting with Darpana Sheth, who is senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Does the problem vary from state to state? Are there some states that have a bigger problem with civil forfeiture than others?
That is true. Now, we've seen in the last couple of years, a lot of states have enacted very comprehensive reform. So in the last 2 years, over 20 states plus the District of Columbia have really taken the initiative and passed comprehensive reform addressing these flaws. But the problem does vary state by state. And, of course, each state has their forfeiture laws and then their federal forfeiture laws. North Carolina, for example, has very good forfeiture laws at the state level. The Institute for Justice issued a report called – it's a landmark study called Policing for Profit that grades every jurisdiction's forfeiture laws based on how well they protect property owners' rights according to the process, how much law enforcement will use forfeiture proceeds to benefit themselves, that direct profit incentive we were talking about, and the transparency, how accountable law enforcement is and how transparent these laws are in terms of their use of forfeiture and how forfeiture proceeds are spent. Now, North Carolina received a B-plus for its forfeiture laws. It was very good in terms of protecting property owners' rights. For example, it only allows civil forfeiture when there has been a criminal conviction, except in racketeering cases, which is the exception. And it also does not allow law enforcement to benefit directly from forfeiture proceeds. Under state law, all forfeiture proceeds must go to fund public schools. Unfortunately, their transparency requirements are not as great, so it didn't get an A. But the problem with North Carolina and many other states is that even where the state laws are very protective of property owner rights, there's a big loophole called the Federal Equitable Sharing Program. Now, under this program, state and local law enforcement can seize property and team up with federal authorities to bring a federal forfeiture action, and in exchange get up to 80% of forfeiture proceeds. And this provides a very direct financial incentive for state and local law enforcement to evade their own stricter state laws in favor of the more lax federal forfeiture laws. And, for example, North Carolina takes huge advantage of this loophole. From 2000 to 2013, North Carolina took in $162 million in equitable sharing proceeds just from the Justice Department and an additional $42 million from the Treasury Department's forfeiture program.
In the brief time that we have left, are there some reforms that North Carolina could put in place that would help protect property rights even more?
Yes, especially North Carolina. So it's already got the great state laws on the books. What it could do is prohibit the ability of state and local law enforcement to participate in the federal equitable sharing program, or at the very least require that equitable sharing proceeds, rather than going back to state and local law enforcement as it currently does under DOJ policy, those proceeds should go back according to state law, to fund public schools. And that would remove the profit incentive. It could also increase its transparency and reporting requirements.
Well, it's a very interesting topic, especially for people who are fans of property rights. We've been speaking with Darpana Sheth, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at JohnLockeNC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted to scrap key pieces of the controversial Dodd-Frank financial regulations. Congress approved those regulations in the wake of the last financial crisis. Now, the U.S. House's alternative is called the Financial Choice Act. One of its supporters on the House floor, North Carolina's 10th District Congressman, Patrick McHenry.
Small businesses and families are the backbone of small rural communities like the ones I represent in Western North Carolina. The fact is that Dodd-Frank has had a crushing impact both on the ability of families and small businesses to access loans and the financial products that they need and deserve. Half of what community banks did prior to Dodd-Frank were lending to small businesses. Now it's down to 20% of what they do. That's as a result of regulation, so as a result of a mess of regulations that have come about as a result of Dodd-Frank. For families, the availability of services that they used to commonly think is acceptable, like free checking and mortgage lending, are significantly diminished or altogether gone for them. And since Dodd-Frank became law, nearly three-quarters of community banks have either left or greatly reduced their mortgage businesses. This is problematic for families. And the impact on these changes has hit rural communities like the ones I represent in Western North Carolina the hardest. But it doesn't end there. The law's mandates, have driven up the cost of borrowing, making it harder and more expensive for families to access credit or save for important life events like saving for your child's college education. Mr. Speaker, the Financial Choice Act changes much of this. It begins to undo the damage caused by Dodd-Frank by removing onerous Washington mandates, very expensive regulations, by cutting off access to financial products that the American people need and desire. Additionally, the Financial Choice Act actually addresses the plight of small businesses by cleaning up these messy regulations that are unclear, that have made the marketplace less safe and secure for lending and small businesses, and encouraging the use of innovative new forms of capital formation that help businesses grow and prosper. That means jobs. This bill is directed at growing the American economy, getting us back on our feet, and helping expand prosperity, not just to urban or rural areas, but to both, to all Americans. I urge my colleagues to vote for this important bill and get on with the business of legislating.
That's North Carolina's 10th District Congressman, Republican Patrick McHenry, speaking from the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. The House approved the Financial Choice Act by a vote of 233 to 186. U.S. senators have expressed more skepticism about the proposal, but the idea would need support from both the House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want this state to support the movement called Convention of States. It involves state legislatures taking the lead in amending the United States Constitution. They recently got some high-profile support from former U.S. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma.
Our country, as most Americans recognize, is in trouble. And we're in trouble fiscally. We're in trouble from a leadership standpoint. And with my 16 years of experience in Washington, I saw no signs that anybody in Washington is going to fix the problems that are really plaguing our country. And our founders were wise. They gave us a way to do that. And I see it as the only solution that returns decision-making to the people. You know, the real question in our country today is, with all the controversy, is who decides? And it ought to be the people deciding, not unelected bureaucrats working in federal agencies telling us what we will and won't do with our lives. So I got involved in it because I thought it was the most important thing I could do outside of I certainly didn't accomplish what I went to Congress for, which was to limit the federal government, restore the balance of power between the states and the federal government, and eliminate the waste, fraud, and abuse that's there. So this is the way to do it.
Why not just elect more like-minded people who want to clean up government?
If you could truly get people who weren't politicians to be in Washington, I think that's true. And that's what you hear from the hard, hard right. All we need to do is elect better people. But we don't have time to wait for that. You know, we're now number 17 in economic freedom in the world. We led the world for 200 years in economic freedom. Why are we number 17? Because we've lost the vision of a free enterprise, personal responsibility and accountability country. And we need to restore that. And the way you restore that is by placing more responsibility at the local level and with the individual.
What about your time in Congress convinces you that the current system is unsustainable?
What I saw is the natural conflict of interest of individuals in positions of power when it came to making decisions about staying in position of power versus doing the best thing. And what I saw all the time was people would not do the best thing, but they'd do the thing that was expedient for their political career. And I think that's human nature. The fact is we have different kinds of people in Washington today. You know, 2/3 of the people in Washington have never served in a real job. They've been in a political office their whole life. And so they don't have the broad experience. And what they're interested in is their political career. And that's not necessarily bad as long as you have the courage to stand up and make the tough votes. But we don't have it.
We're speaking with former U.S. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma about the proposed Convention of States. You're known for fighting waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government. How would this convention help address that issue?
Number one is if you force a balanced budget amendment with generally accepted accounting principles. You know, Oklahoma has a balanced budget amendment, but they cheat every year. They go into debt and say, well, we've balanced the budget. With generally accepted accounting principles where it's all transparency and you actually get to see where the federal government's spending its money and you make them use generally accepted accounting principles, you actually will get and find out what we really are. Here's last year's numbers. $584 billion deficit. What'd the debt go up? $1.6 trillion. What'd the unfunded liabilities go up? $7 trillion. So we told everybody we are only short $600 billion. All right, but it was really $1 trillion more than that. So you can't trust the numbers coming from Washington. They're not real. They're not true. They game them. And so forcing a balanced budget amendment, then limiting the power of Washington and restoring the power of the states and the individual, bring the decision-making home where I can come in and influence my state legislator. I represented 4 million people in the U.S. Senate. I can't meet with 4 million people. But your legislature can meet with their district and they can actually get their attention. And if you talk to your legislators, they'll actually say, well, that's one of my constituents. I'm going to listen to them.
What's the biggest challenge for people supporting a convention of states?
People are fearful. Well, you might do something that would hurt us. And, you know, my answer to that is you've got 535 people in Washington today that can do anything they want if they get 2/3 and send it to you. You think they're going to do that? No, they're not going to send anything that's going to hurt us. So why would the states, where you actually have more control, do anything that would hurt us? We have to help ourselves, otherwise we're going to die. All republics in history have died. We're the longest surviving republic, and they all die over the same issues, fiscal issues, and when they unwind, and we're unwinding right now.
A lot of people don't know much about Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. What's their reaction to this idea?
When they find out about it, they get all excited. They say, you mean I can actually do something? We can actually take back some of the power that's been given to us. We can get our freedom back. We can actually move decision-making to our state house or to our county government away from Washington. And everybody at some point in time has experienced the long hand of an unelected bureaucrat making a decision that on the ground everybody knows is not the right decision. But because there's money tied to it, we're extorted to do what that long hand of the federal bureaucrat says.
What about people who think this process could get hijacked by supporters of a larger federal government?
You have to believe that the 13 judiciary chairmen in the United States of all the states would allow something like that to get hijacked. So, because remember, whatever comes out of a convention of amendments, and it's limited what can be offered. So they're wrong on that count. It's by jurisprudence and history, it's limited what you can offer. Outside of your application, you can offer nothing. But you have to believe that the 13 judiciary chairmen would allow. It only takes 13 to stop anything, right? So you, out of the 99 judiciary chairmen, because Nebraska has a unicameral legislature, it would take only 13 to stop anything. Well, listen, I've been in 35 states. I actually trust the people a whole lot more than I trust Washington. The biggest problem I see is legislators in North Carolina may not have confidence in legislators in Virginia or Kentucky or in Nebraska. I find them all to be about pretty much the same. They want their freedom. They want their privileges. They want to be able to make decisions for their people and in the best interest of their people, not with having somebody from Washington tell them, here's what you have to do. And so, again, our country was built on courage, not fear. And if you're going to fear something, you ought to fear the runaway federal government we have today and fear what's going to happen to our children. Right now, the millennial generation is on the hook over the next 50 years for $1.75 million apiece in unfunded liabilities that we're consuming now. So if you fear anything, if you really love your children, you'll get on board with this so we can change that.
What's your elevator speech supporting the Convention of States?
Our founders were prescient. They knew that there's never been a time in history where a central government voluntarily ceded back its power to the people. So they put this in here in case the federal government ever got to the point where they were non-responsive to the needs and requirements and freedom of the individuals in their country. This was, and it has been used. Most people don't realize that the Bill of Rights came about because John Jay and James Madison were putting forward an Article 5 convention for amendments to install the Bill of Rights into the U.S. Constitution. The Congress looked at that and they said, we'll pass it. We don't want them telling us what to do. And that's something that will happen with this, is if in fact we get to 30 states, the Congress is going to start saying, wow, we better do these three things or they're going to do it for us.
That's former U.S. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma visiting North Carolina to tout the Convention of States movement. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Social networking sites connect us to the world around us, but tension is mounting over how to prevent people from abusing social media while ensuring their right to free speech. That tension was highlighted in the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in Packingham versus North Carolina. The John Locke Foundation's John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies. He's joining us now to talk about this case in particular, but also to describe the scenario that he says is new media plus new laws equals new problems. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Packingham versus North Carolina, 8-0 ruling out of the U.S. Supreme Court that overturns the North Carolina Supreme Court. Who was Packingham? And tell us about the facts of the case.
Packingham was a convicted sex offender. He, as a young man, I think at the age of 20, was convicted of having sex with a 13-year-old girl. And under North Carolina law, anybody who's a registered sex offender, including Mr. Packingham, is forbidden from using a whole range of social media sites, including things like Facebook. As it happened, somebody who was monitoring his case as a registered sex offender noticed that he was using Facebook and had posted something on there. It had nothing to do with sex. He was simply crowing about the fact that he'd been cited for a traffic violation and the case had been dismissed. But simply using Facebook at all was violating the law in North Carolina, and he was charged with that. It went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and at that point, the conviction was upheld, but he appealed, and it ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court, and they reversed.
The basis of his argument had to do with his right to free speech?
Entirely. It was a First Amendment free speech claim against the constitutionality of this law.
Let's talk first about what happened and what the reasoning was with the North Carolina Supreme Court in his case. Tell us why they said, no, you cannot use social media.
They made a move which is somewhat understandable, but at the time when I wrote about it last year, I said it was it was back in 2015. I called it a stretch. Under ordinary constitutional jurisprudence, it's very hard to make a law that limits people's freedom of speech. The U.S. Constitution provides very strong protections for those rights. So what the North Carolina Supreme Court did was they said what we're dealing with here isn't really a law that restricts freedom of speech. It's a law that's directed at conduct. That conduct is getting access to social media. Therefore, any restrictions on freedom of speech are incidental to that conduct, and we can look at them at a much lower level of scrutiny. And in this case, they said these are permissible restrictions on an incidental right to freedom of speech that only happens to occur because they're regulating his conduct. That was how they approached the case, and I called it a stretch, and it seems as if the U.S. Supreme Court agreed.
Why did you believe it was a stretch, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court did agree with you?
Well, it seems pretty obvious that what was being regulated here wasn't simply logging into a website. It was using the website. And what do we do on Facebook or any of these other things? We either read what other people have written or we write things ourselves. It's speech is the point of what's going on. It's what the legislature wanted to regulate. And of course, if there were any harm to be done, it would happen through speech. I mean, what the legislature is worried about quite legitimately is that somebody might use Facebook and other social media platforms to find young susceptible people and lure them into some kind of a liaison. And all that would happen, if it happened at all, only through speech.
Does the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court mean that North Carolina's law is moot? It's unconstitutional?
It does. If the legislature wants to do something about this problem, they're going to go back to the drawing board.
So Mr. Packingham can indeed access Facebook if he wants to.
Well, let me preface this. Let me predicate here a little bit. The U.S. Supreme Court remanded this to the North Carolina Supreme Court, so they're going to get another crack at it. Uh-huh. However, the opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court was so clear and emphatic that this was a violation, and I think that at the end of the day, the legislature is going to have to think again.
So if it goes back to the North Carolina Supreme Court and the legislature perhaps gets involved, what does that mean for other people who presumably, John, are affected by this North Carolina law as well, not just Mr. Packingham?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that even registered sex offenders are going to get to use Facebook. The real question going forward is what's permissible now in the way of regulation about these kinds of things, because it seems legitimate to be worried about people using platforms like Facebook to find susceptible victims. And that isn't very clear from the opinion. And that's one of the reasons why several of the justices, while they concurred in the result, weren't willing to sign on to the opinion because they thought there's a lot more to be said about this.
And in fact, you had actually pointed out some of the comments that Justice Alito made in the opinion. Was that essentially his point?
Yes, that was his point. He wrote a pretty strong concurrence in which he said, I go along with the result here. Clearly, this is regulation of speech, and it's not justifiable regulation of speech because it's not narrowly tailored to the objective here, which is to keep people from abusing Facebook and other social media platforms to find victims for sexual abuse. However, the way it was written by Justice Stevens is so open-ended and so effusive that it makes it seem as if platforms like Facebook are the new town square, they're the new city street, they're the new public park where everybody should be allowed to speak, and it's vitally important. And Justice Alito said, we don't really know that yet. There's a lot we don't know about how free speech is going to operate in the digital age, and we should take it one step at a time.
It seems that this area of innovation, all the technology and communication and being tapped into literally the world, that the legal industry, the law, is lagging behind. the technology.
It is, and it's pretty much bound to be that way. I noted at the end of my piece that it's not just the courts and the legislatures who have a lot to learn here. It's the rest of us. The people, the internet service providers, they're brilliant people involved, and they've got a lot of technical skill, and they need to learn how to figure out how to do better about preventing their platforms from being abused. And the rest of us have to learn how to do better too. I mean, we need to protect our children, and I don't think we can rely on the legislatures or even the internet service providers to protect us. We need to find ways to protect our children ourselves as well.
And what a quandary that is for all of us, but particularly I think the internet service providers, John. I mean, how can you really monitor? Do you do it by keywords or phrases?
I'm the last person who could tell you this. I could barely use these sites myself. But I think it's worth noting that they have taken it upon themselves to monitor their users for offensive speech, what they call hate speech, and they take down sites and they ban users who they feel are abusing so-called community standards. So I'm not sure I'm not at all worried that it's beyond their technical capabilities to do at least a better job than they have done up until now, and I hope they will.
Well, you've written a really interesting piece on this case, Packingham v. North Carolina, and you can read it at johnlock.org. Our guest has been the author of that piece. He is John Guzet, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies and attorney himself. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org. Or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.